back. WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. I am going to be taking a break from a little bit of sports here and be thankful for Thanksgiving and all the things we're doing. We're doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour on Friday at Black Friday in Abingdon at Conrad's Crabs. Come on out and have a crab cake with Harford County Executive Barry Glass. We'll also be at Pappas in Cockeysville on the 3rd of December. There's a rumor Mike Bordick is joining us. I'll try to get that confirmed a little later in the week, as well as Jim Reeves from Offutt Kerman, as well as my dear friend Leonard Raskin from Raskin Global. Talk a little money. That's December 3rd. It's all presented by the Maryland Lottery. You know, I love music. I talk about music a lot around here. We try to have as many musicians on as we can. Once in a while, some famous people drop by and some not so famous people. And Ed Lauer still, and Paul Lamantia, I'm still searching out my own guitarist to come on the program. Never had this guy on the program. He is long lost and left Baltimore, but still sort of airplanes in, and we keep many of friends through the music industry. Dave Geller has produced and put on shows and been a part of shows and promoted shows many, many years ago. I don't even know where the hell he is. I thought he lived in Denver at one point. I think he's in Florida somewhere now. He just told me before we green room, which I never do, as Don Mohler will tell you, that he actually grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and parts of Cincinnati and Long Island and other places. But, dude, I know you through music and love of music, and I don't think I've talked to you in 10 or 15 years, like talk to you like I'm doing now. But we've remained in contact through all of these years, and I think of you and I think of music, and this tragedy happened in Houston a couple weeks ago, and it's terrible the tragedy brings us together, but you inspired me last year to put together my favorite albums, and it became this thing in the middle of the plague that actually soothed my soul. So I appreciate that. It's been a year and a half since I put my 31 albums in 31 days in May of 2020 out. And it's good to have you on. How are you, Dave?
Thanks for having me. Super great. I live in Miami Beach. I'm live to you today from St. Augustine, Florida, the oldest city in America. Took a little road trip with my brother before Thanksgiving. But I'm doing well. I hope you are too, bro. I feel like we talk all the time, even though we don't. I feel like you're ubiquitously in my life.
Well, social media, like literally, yes. there is an ambient thing to knowing what people do and where they are in their worlds. Ex-girlfriends, people from seventh grade, people I grew up with. We dedicated my elementary school, you know, that a couple weeks ago, and people, and it's beautiful. It's really beautiful during the holiday season and Thanksgiving, and so. The concert thing and the music thing, let's take this back to roots, right? I was a music critic in the late 80s at the Baltimore Sun and the Evening Sun and Meriwether Post Pavilion and Pier 6. I was with Jason Wright all morning in Chicago. Jason picked me up at my door, picked my bag up for me because my back's all effed up, introduced me to his kids. He was in a journalism program. Nobody got a word in edgewise other than journalism and Indiana and media and all this stuff. And I have so many friends in the music business that I relish in my 50s, but what I really relish is the music itself. And you think of me as a sports guy, and you didn't want to talk Ravens and Orioles and all that because it's not your jam. And maybe
no, I think of you as a music guy. I just really wanted to make sure I wasn't didn't look like a complete uninformed sports idiot on this
No. It's not even like that. But the music part of this is when the plague happened, right? So we're 2 years removed from this. They took sports away from the conversation. They took live everything away. I mean, you're masking up to go to a grocery store, to go to Wise. And, you know, by the way, I had some Wise ice cream. I'll plug my sponsors. This is my Wise scooper. I was eating some pumpkin ice cream here this morning. And life was so weird. But then, like, Tommy Shaw's doing a webcast and playing some songs for me. And I love the Bodines. Ooh. And Kurt Newman's on Facebook reworking old Bodine songs, right? In weird ways and making videos and stuff, right? So all of these musicians, Eddie Lauer's on at 2 a.m. and my wife's streaming them, right? And from his basement and giving him $5 and like whatever. Everything changed, and when life got taken away, the last show I saw was Cheap Trick at the Warner Theater. Debbie Rondo, yeah,
love Debbie. Right? So Geller Group, old school.
So I'm going old. I'm shouting out how much I love these people and how much they're intertwined in my life. You put me on this musical challenge last May that I became obsessed. I mean, in the middle of the night, my wife's like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, I'm writing about the KTEL album where I discovered Hall & Oates singing Sarah Smile, okay? So it's important to me, right? So music's so important to me, and you've made a living on it. And this tragedy happened a couple of weeks ago at a festival, and I think of you as a festival guy. So I'll tell everybody who you are and how we got together, because we've known each other a long time, and I know you as a music guy.
I was promoting concerts as a very young man, maybe 21 years old, in New York, in the Hamptons, and I think doing a fairly good job of it, a good enough job where the existing promoters were like, who the hell is this guy, Dave Geller? I was doing shows at the West Hampton Summer Stage, which was the old Air Officers Club at the Coast Guard Airport in the West Hampton. And I did the Radiators from New Orleans because I had gone to school there, and the Neville Brothers. We did the Smithereens. We did Meatloaf. I was lucky enough to make a relationship with the William Morris Agency pretty young, and so they took a chance. But I made a lot of noise out there, and the two existing promoters, John Scher of Woodstock Infamy, and my now good friend Ron Delsner and Mitch Slater, God rest his soul, were like, this kid needs to come work for us, or he needs to get out of town because, you know, we're not having some competitor like this.
Did you love promoting or love music? You got into it because you probably love the Smithereens, right?
I was pre-law at Loyola University at New Orleans, and I had planned to be a divorce attorney. I probably would have been a pretty good one. But I got on the concert board, and at that point, the object was to blow a budget. And I'm like, why are we not opening the sales up to at least Tulane next door or the public? So that's exactly what we did. And we ended up making money. I did the Allman Brothers, a bunch of other really cool shows. And we made money and did five shows a year instead of losing money on one. And I just had this epiphany, like, this is so cool. Like, I'm like, there's this gymnasium with nothing in it, but I'm bringing in the sound, the lights, I'm bringing in the marketing, and this is what I want to do. It was an absolute epiphany. I was very absolute. I want to be a concert promoter. I think I could do really well at this. And then I got a job at Tipitina's, very famous venue in New Orleans, as the bar
back. I've still never been there, by the way. I'm getting shat upon because I've never been to Tipitina's.
Nice place. Old place. Cool place. I couldn't carry the keg up the stairs. I was too skinny. So they put me in the booking department. And then I, got fired from that job for putting girls on the guest list. And I got busted doing that. And I decided to just start doing shows myself. And the manager of the Neville Brothers and the Meters, very, very significant band in my life, were like, listen, you don't know anything about production. And we're going to teach you production. We're going to need you to show up at the racetrack on this date. And lo and behold, I was hired as the assistant stage manager at the New Orleans Jazz Fest on the main stage, which was the start of my career. I met a million people. I learned an awful lot. We could tell a lot of funny stories about that. But I ended up going back to Long Island and using some of these contacts. And like I said, the big promoters were like, listen, you're either going to work for us or you're not going to be in New York. So at that time is a name I'm sure you'll know, and I love him and I love his daughter, Heidi. But Dick Klotzman was the big promoter in Baltimore. And not to be judgmental, but Dick had gotten himself into a lot of trouble.
Well, the Painter's Mill stories, famous and infamous. And I actually follow the old Painter's Mill. I saw Frankie Valli at Painter's Mill in 1980. Exactly. I still got the little ticket stub. My mom loved the Four Seasons. And, I love December 1963, right? And,
I like that song too. So anyway,
you're just too good to be true. I can't take my eyes off of you.
I love that song. So, a very famous agent, Chip Hooper, God rest his soul, Dave Matthews, many, many big bands. And another agent, Jonathan Levine, who does the Grateful Dead and so many other big bands. Like, hey, listen, you before Loyola, you went to Towson. There's a vacuum in the marketplace. You should go back to Baltimore. I go to Baltimore. So I came to Baltimore and I started doing a bunch of shows. And I was working with Ron Furman at Max's on Broadway.
I had Ron on. We did an hour together a couple of weeks ago on the Crab Cake tour. Love down Ron. At the Chop Tank. And we were telling the stories of, you know, the Rembrandts and the lights going out, and they put the candles on, and we told the story. Like,
I'm not sure was it the Rembrandts?
It was the Rembrandts. There was another one where it happened too.
There was another one where the lights went out.
I think it was Himmelman, maybe.
Maybe Peter Himmelman.
Yeah, maybe.
That's an incredible. That was actually incredible. I'm so glad you brought that up. The only other candlelight show I remember being as poignant was the Pearl Jam playing at the George Mason University the day after Kurt died, and they didn't put the lights on.
They put candelabras up.
But anyway, I came to Baltimore. I'm working with Ron, and it's working. I'm doing some shows here and there. And they're like, listen, you need to connect with Seth Hurwitz and IMP. And back in those days, like, Seth wouldn't take my call, and I would send him a fax every day, a handwritten fax every day. And finally, like 90 days into this process, he's like, what the fuck? Can I curse?
Yeah, you just did. It's fine.
Sorry. You know, what do you want?
My audience has heard that word. It's fine.
You know, so I ended up having lunch with Seth and his partner, Rich Heineke, and we hit it off. And I started, we helped Damien Bohager rip his sort of open air kitchen out. We helped put the stage in there. And the first 15 or 20 shows at Bohager sold out. And Seth was like, wow, this is amazing. We really can book the shows in DC and Baltimore. It can work.
I had Jimmy Babjack from the Smithereens on a couple of weeks ago telling the story playing there.
I briefly swept over that before Seth and I got involved with Bohagers, Jason Wright was my partner. I love Jason. I knew Jason from his dad.
And I told him on Sunday I like his dad better. Not that I didn't like him, but I like his dad better.
His dad's cooler than. But so Jason and I were partners, and in about 2 or 3 months into the partnership, he was given this incredible opportunity to work for Mark Campana at the time Clear Channel before they were Live Nation. And I said, bro, like, you know, who knows what's going to happen with this experiment. And he went on, and now he's one of the regional presidents. He's one of my favorite people in the world. He's a super important guy in this business. And it was really cool to start.
I realized that when he got his front row parking in Chicago at Soldier Field, because my back.
No, he's the real deal guy. In any case, so shortly after that, Brian Burkert, who I knew from the Soundgarden record store, who I thought was the absolutely fucking coolest record store in the country, other than maybe Amoeba Music at the time. But like, then I really loved Brian, and he had acquired Fletcher's, and Seth was like, you know what? I like this. You know, we have this record store relationship. This guy's got a couple bucks, and we're going to do this right. We're going to have this small room. We're going to have this big room, Bohagers. And we eventually, you know, got the contract at Hammer Jack's for some period of time before Louis, who I love, Principio just kind of, Seth was like, this is like really a crazy situation. Like, this guy is like selling tickets at the back door. And like, this is just crazy. Like, so, but we went on to use, you know, obviously the Baltimore Arena and tons of different things. And, you know, Seth was really cool. And he was like, listen, like, I don't really like doing radio shows. I had a really good relationship with Bill Pasha, who was the program director, at, you know, Mix 106, for that group of radio stations. So I started doing the radio shows on my own, which was pretty lucrative and pretty cool. And then I was lucky enough after the O'Malley victory in 1999 to be awarded the Artscape contract, which I did for many years and really loved that.
Saw Roger Daltrey with the orchestra that night. Mind-blowing, dude. The Floyd songs and doing the Zeppelin songs. It was
there's
insane.
Been so many great shows at Artscape. So then my good friend, now Congressman Kwasi Nfume, then president of the NAACP, Mr. Nfume, drafted me to do the African American Heritage Festival. in the parking lot of Oriole Park, not under the bridge, but actually that was something I'm really proud of. And, you know, Steph and I did the Virgin Festival at Pimlico for many years. And then
got the Police back together from my
remember. Yes. Well, yeah. It was a little underwhelming, but we did do that. And finally, you know, and, you know, through my political antics, I had become really good friends with Ken Ullman, who at the time was a county councilman on his way to being county executive, and made me aware of the bidding process for Meriwether. And I headed that process up, you know, in terms of the bidding process with IMP. And we were lucky to get it and inherited an incredible partnership with Gene Parker, the general manager.
Now, of all the people we've mentioned, including John Wright, I like Gene Parker better than anybody you've met. And I like them all.
Gene Parker's grave will sweat. I mean, Gene Parker truly is the closest thing to a saint. She is the quiet champion hero. She is the heartbeat of Meriwether Post Pavilion. And she has been for... I don't want to embarrass her, but I bet you it's coming up on 40 years.
It is coming up on 40 years. We talked about that.
And she's an incredibly dedicated executive, just an incredible human being who's been through a lot personally. There wouldn't be Meriwether without Gene and equally Brad. They kept the place up when it was abandoned by Live Nation, kept it on people's radar. Very much have overseen a bunch of the development.
What do you think? Would you cry when you walk in there? Sometimes I get emotional. Like, when I see that building and I have memories there, and it's a sacred space to me. You know, like anytime I go down there now with my son or something, I'm like, my God, look at how beautiful this place is.
it's Jim Rouse, the original developer of Columbia, developer of Harbor Place, you know, had a real vision for. I don't know what the terminology is in planning, but like a mixed community, a mix of classes, a mix of races, and where there was all these community assets, parks, swimming pools, this amphitheater, town center, the idea of the mall there. So just the fundamental idea of Columbia, let alone Symphony Woods, as a well-meaning person makes me cry. You know, I left a really good job with Seth with this portfolio of venues, 930 Club included. I'd met the band Thievery Corporation, Seth and I managed them together. I wanted to run away with the circus and manage bands, and the industry was getting really corporatized. But I don't have many regrets, but I actually regret when I walk into Meriwether. I very much, I'm still part of the family. I'm still an honored guest, talk to Seth all the time, but... I'm really proud of that place and what it's become. And there's a big part of me that would love to have still been involved there. It's an incredible group of people. It's an incredible venue in between two major markets. And what Symphony Woods in downtown Columbia has become, as your friend Damien O'Doherty could explain better than myself, is it's mind-blowing, as you said. But yeah, it does make me cry for a variety of reasons. I've seen some amazing shows. Had so many amazing experiences, have been entertained myself personally, thousands of people there. And I think it's a really, really special place in the world.
Dave Geller is a special guy in the world. He's joining us from St. Augustine, but not from his palatial estate in Miami Beach, now that I know. Stone Crabs are in season. I missed the game a few weeks ago. I know where the beach is. Dave, we've been at this a long time, and I can talk about my 31 albums and have a good time with that, and I was going to go in that direction, but I do want to speak about the festival and speak about safety and security and insurance and why it costs me so much money and why beers are $16 when I'm at Meriwether, which I'm never really pleased about, but I was so affected by the plague and not being able to go to a show. Any price was a good price. I had Steve Whiteman from Kicks on, and he's shaking his ass at a drive-in theater on a 40-degree night, and people were sitting on the hoods of cars, and it's like a Grease movie, right? And people are having a good time. And I even said to John Allen, you're my lifer friend, you know, like, hey, you can take Stone Horses out playing a drive-in theater. He's like, that dude was pretty cool. It was better than I thought it was going to be, you know. I think anything that provides variety at this point, and I'm getting to that point where I like different foods and trying different things.
Yeah, the older you get, variety is important.
See, well, I'm going to be in Pittsburgh in a couple weeks, and I love REO Speedwagon, right? And I haven't seen him in 10 years, right? I really want to go to the show. It's the night after the Steelers game. They're playing some little beautiful looking.
Oh, they're not playing a pack. They usually play a package with a co-headliner.
They're playing Green something. They're playing a theater, Palace Theater, this little tiny theater in the middle of Pittsburgh suburbs. And I'm like, I might want to go to that because I've never been to that theater, right? So for me, all of these venues and all of this stuff, I've been to the Astrodome, the Tragedy down there, but like all of the industry is. A lot of us want to come back, but COVID, safety, protocols, all of these things, it's a different environment. And I can't imagine working in it. You're working in it every day trying to put a band on the road, right?
Well, let's start with festivals, Astroworld, safety, mass gathering, because it's becoming a bigger and bigger business in America. For a long time, like that was actually a European model. Clubs are kind of shitty in Europe and in the summertime. Especially because most people have off, it's different over there. But like in America, you know, Live Nation has bought a ton of festivals. There are already a ton of festivals, and it's a great, actually a pretty good value on the admission side, you know, being able to see 15, 20 or 60 bands, you know, for 100, 150 bucks isn't the worst deal in the world. But in terms of Astroworld, I think a lot of things went wrong there. First of all, full disclosure, my friend Sasha Stone Goodfried from Scoremore was the primary promoter. Really good dude, mid-30s, just owns the hip-hop rap game in Texas amongst a lot of competition. Was bought by Live Nation. Some of the Live Nation team was involved. And I don't believe that what happened there was per se, a lack of professionalism. The first obvious low-hanging fruit thing that I think that will be discovered in the investigation is the same problem that a lot of businesses are having. There's no staff. That's very dangerous for concerts. You know, the concert experience sort of starts in the parking lot and the perimeter security, the inside security. Not only do you want these people to guard the perimeter, but they're there to keep people safe. They're there to give people information, steer them in the right direction. So I think it's both a quality and quantity issue where some of these really important primary interaction positions are A, understaffed, and B, the quality of people
available, right?
Correct. It is not great.
Well, they say the show must go on, right?
And correct.
You know, right.
But, you know, there's a plan that's approved by the insurance company. It's approved by the city of Houston, because I believe that the Cordish company is involved with that venue, strangely, but they're involved with the old Astro Stadium. In any case, there's a lot of eyeballs that the ops plan, it's not just like, hey, let's throw a concert, gets put on. So none of it's nonchalant. I think that another ingredient to play that we are going to have to address as an industry, it's like if you have a 50,000 person capacity event, but only 30,000 people fit towards the main stage, and your strategy is that like a Ferris wheel or some bullshit second stage is going to pull enough people from the gross capacity away from the main stage, that's not really well thought out. Like at Lollapalooza, or Austin City Limits, which in full disclosure, I used to work with that company directly, you know, they will have Miley Cyrus and George Strait. They will, at ACL, they'll have two reliably big draws at opposite ends of the thing and pull this 100,000 people into capacity. So I think one thing that went wrong at Astroworld is that I don't think that the production and the capacity, it just was too small for the whole show to be there. And lastly, in my opinion, I have no beef with Travis Scott, but Travis Scott has become as famous I hate to use the word inciting the crowd, but ramping them up. Like that's his thing. Like he likes to get the energy at a palpable riot level thing. And that's fine if there's no problem. But like, the guy was criminally charged in Chicago for doing it at Lollapalooza. This isn't something new. I like rap culture. I like hip hop culture. You cannot take anything away from Travis Scott's talent and his celebrity. But like, you got to have some responsibility. You know, as we learn too many times, you know, there's a lot of lives at stake. I think we're up to about 10 people dead with kids dead. Like this.
Well, Dave, we go back to Altamont, right, with this or right. whatever, right? But I would also
don't
say
don't take the brown acid. Sorry,
the green pills, right? That was the green M&Ms, and they're not on the Van Halen rider, but that's a whole rock and roll thing. Dave Geller is here, longtime promoter and my friend, lots of Baltimore roots. You went through that. We're talking about concerts and where we are in the aftermath of this tragedy. I've seen so many clips of artists over the years, old videos of artists stopping shows and saying, hey, shit's getting rough up here. Stop. We don't want anybody hurt. And all, across all genre, not black, not white, not rap, not anywhere, right? That there is a level of energy and alcohol and sometimes drug use and sometimes a mosh pit. And, you know, you keep the weapons out these days, right? I mean, that's why we get frisked down and I stand out in the cold and before a Bruce Springsteen concert, freezing my ass off to wait to get in and get frisked down and all of that. We've become this violent society that we're trying to, I mean, I've been to shows in Argentina. I've been to shows all over the world where you get rubbed down or you don't get rubbed down. I've been in airports in Australia where you just walk up and get on the gate and they don't even like look for a gun. New Zealand, right? Literally, right? So it's weird place to place, but where we are right now in America, in the modern era, every artist should be concerned about this right now. And I guess I'm asking you how this is going to change festivals because I don't go to Firefly. I don't love the big festival thing. I like stadium shows and whatnot, but I don't like being in a field. It's not my.
Well, one interesting thing, I'm not certain about this, but from the clips I've seen, you know, there's something called a T barricade where it runs vertically down from the front of house to the horizontal line of the stage, and it basically separates the crowd into two. That practice was actually first instituted in Maryland and in DC, strangely. But it's become I haven't been to a festival of that size or Astroworld where that type of barricade wasn't used. That's perhaps neither here nor there. What's going to happen in a post thing? One thing you briefly touched upon is like, in my opinion, like part of what's going on is like you have this angst. You have this angst among the progressive left, you know, anti-establishment angst, anti-rules. You know, you have certainly in the minority and ethnic communities, like, hey, man, like the police or this or that. There's a lot of tension in society, you know, on the conservative right, you know, that we're angry at each other. Music for thousands of years was a place where people came together to put those tensions aside and celebrate. And I very much hoped that, as you said, post-COVID, that music would be a healing element for our souls, for our minds, for our comfort.
And it has been for me, clearly, right? Clearly.
And me, but unfortunately, I think what Astroworld might demonstrate, and again, you know, to be very clear, like as the death toll indicates, is probably a lot more white people at Astroworld than were black people. This isn't necessarily a racial observation. It's just I think that there's this tension is entering into restaurants, venues,
airplanes.
This and that. I'm hoping that the messaging from stage, the messaging from artists, the signage, the vibe, the type of people you want to be staffed at this thing, as you would say, you know, Baltimore positive, world positive, music positive, like music's supposed to be a positive thing. Yes, there's certain types and genres of music that are revolutionary and reflect the challenges of the world we live in, but by and large, we're there to enjoy it. There's an old edict in the punk thing, like, hey, someone goes down the mosh pit, you pick them up. I'd like to see that become a universal thing in GA crowds where it gets a little active in the front or people push like, hey man, someone falls down, like let's everyone pick them up. That would be a good thing. I think.
Well, in my childhood, it was the Who concert in Cincinnati. You know, there were tragedies to remind us that it's very important that promoters and security and all of the things that are a bit of a pain in the ass if you're in front, right, or whatever, they won't let you down onto the field. There's too many people down here, right? So there's a little bit of that that I've had my own childhood angst. I loved being up front, right? We all do.
Right. But I think to touch on something you kind of asked about briefly. So the insurance is very interesting. When you're talking especially about festivals and liability insurance for people that start gathering 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100,000 people a day, there's very few entities in the world that insure that. In fact, you can't even get insurance for a festival that size from one person, like Lloyd's of London, per se, or Fireman's Fund. A broker will couple together multi-million dollars of risk under many carriers. So those carriers have a lot of sway, not only in best practices, but evolving best practices. And I think that you're going to see coming from those insurance companies a little bit tighter regulation, could be the reduction of some capacities. To the degree that these gatherings happen in places where the municipality has ownership, equity, or skin in the game, police, fire, city hall, you know, they're going to need to limit their liability as well. And so I think there'll be some changes. These cities and these police departments and the unions, to a degree, their union venues, make a lot of money. And so politically, it's kind of hard to get the capacity genie back in the bottle. I mean,
that's where the money comes from.
More people,
more money. Right. Period.
And I think for newer festivals, there could be a little tighter set of regulations. And maybe that's a good thing. I mean, you know, the festival thing in America, you know, Lollapalooza, I think it just celebrated 20 years. It was a very touring sort of alternative lifestyle van.
Jason Wright and his son were explaining it to me as they drove me through the park to the stadium on Sunday, what Lollapalooza is. And, you know, I've been there for Wilco, and there were 150,000 people down there for Wilco. It was crazy.
Yeah.
I've seen that, and that's part of my gig, and our time is running a little short. Dave Geller's here. Dave, I just want to say, having this sort of information, I'd love to have you back on as we ramp into the season, bro, because I'm not sitting talking music all day, but the insights that you provide, and for the experience, because we all love music, we all love going, my whole world, whether it's country, it's not my thing, or rap, which isn't my thing, but rock, which isn't my thing, going to shows has been a great outlet for all of us, and the cost of it, the pain in the ass of all of it, the insurance, all of that is
a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, is wrapped up in our safety. It really is. People want to know that they're safe going to a show, whether it's COVID or not. So let's consider this the first of hopefully an ongoing series, because I definitely want to talk about your favorite albums and my favorite albums as well.
Bro, anytime. I'm glad you're doing well. Love to Baltimore and all my friends, Dave Rather, Tim Condor, Adam Smolin, Colleen Martin-Lauer, and the whole gang. Love you guys.
It's everybody on my Facebook page. I like that. I appreciate that. Dave, next time, more time. Dave Geller, a longtime promoter, talking festivals and talking safety and talking memories and talking about how cool Merriweather Post is. And it is. Baltimore Positive. That's right. Columbia Positive. Howard County Positive. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. And we never stop talking Baltimore Positive.